Hey there. This is my podcast with Anna Klemm. Anna is the head of the Bioimage Informatics facility at SAIF Life Lab in Sweden. While Anna and I are in many ways colleagues, connected via bioimage analysis and SAIF Life Lab, we don't share the same workspace and we don't usually get the chance to just talk. Therefore, it was a great pleasure to have her on the podcast and talk about her transition from researcher to facility staff, from Germany to Sweden. How did she get involved with NewBias, which is probably the way in which most of you know about Anna, because she was heavily involved in the NewBias training schools and then lately in the very popular series of webinars by NewBias Academy. We also discuss about women in science and many other topics. I hope that you enjoy listening to this as much as I had fun talking to Anna. And now, with any further delay, I bring to you my conversation with Anna Klemm, bioimage analysis, facilities, and the Nordics.
I will leave the meeting now.
Yeah. This would be the shortest episode of them all. Hello, Anna. Goodbye, Anna. So, Anna, thanks a lot for joining me. It's really a great pleasure.
And thank you.
And also, thank you for managing me to, you know, like allowing me to convince you to just, you know, join me into this. So, for everybody that is just listening today, I'm talking to Anna Klemm. And we have met each other because we both work with image analysis, particularly bioimage analysis. And then maybe Anna, if you can just say hello to everybody.
Hello, I'm Anna. Shall I introduce myself? How did you plan
please.
This? I'm a bioimage analyst. I'm working at the Bioimage Informatics Facility of SciLife Lab, which is in Uppsala. So I'm in Uppsala. We are actually split up, and I was just thinking while you were saying this where we have met the first time, whether it was at NewBias or whether it was in Gothenburg. Maybe it was
I would believe that it was in Gothenburg actually. Because the thing is that what my first NewBias was actually Luxembourg. Right, because I think we when I arrived to the facility, so when I arrived to CCI in Gothenburg, you know the head of my facility, Julia. So when I arrived, you know that we organized this image analysis course every year. And then when I arrived, she was like, hey, Rafa, you know, like now that you're here, we need to organize this course. And we didn't have so much time to organize it. And then she was like, look, Rafa, you know, what we have is this, you know, like we have usually done it this way, let's say. And she told me the people that have been helping us and teaching. And then she was like, yeah, and you should really reach out to Anna. And then I knew your name from, you know, like these NewBias things, because I have been kind of being involved, just following the, you know, the events, but I have never been there. So I was like, oh, okay, I kind of knew your name from somewhere and I send you an email. But I think that year you couldn't make it.
It's true. I remember exactly. I was for a different course, and then we met, I think, at Scandem instead, which is kind of the Scandinavian microscopy society somehow.
Yes.
And there was the meeting that you co-organized, I guess, with the Julia and your colleagues in
Gothenburg. Exactly.
Exactly. And there
and that was actually a very nice meeting to arrange. Yeah, so that was the first time that we met in person. And then I think most people probably at least know your face and your voice also from the NewBias Academy. So that was your big show. So so I'm actually quite interesting. So how did you feel doing that?
I'm with the NewBias Academy. I did this one course, which then was also basically recorded and uploaded about the ImageJ macro writing. And then, I quite often do this hosting or the sessions and asking questions. It's actually not so. I remember in the very beginning, also for this webinar, I think it was just only 100 participants, but it was like in this beginning of the pandemic. And I remember this kind of count of the participants increasing in Zoom, and then I got quite nervous, I remember, because also you don't see the people, and it was so strange. But then there was, I mean, we were a big team, so I was kind of teaching, but I don't, there were so many helpers around. And then they all had their cameras open, and I remember I was always looking at them, and then I was like talking to friends. And for the webinars, actually I did not host it so often. I think I don't remember, maybe two times only, that I really did like the introduction and then the question. Yes, I think it's fun because you kind of, I mean, anyway, I always thinking I would anyway listen to these webinars anyways. I can also kind of be a bit more active and do something.
Yeah, I remember also there was a couple of them that I was busy, or I was unable to make it, and I was like, oh, I have to wait until the YouTube video comes out. but it's been very interesting to see. Well, first it came out in a way as a response to the pandemic. So because, you know, we could not meet, you know, physically with other people, but also, you know, New Bias is trying different ways now that the grant has, you know, moved into other things. So then we also have to think in how New Bias continues doing what they can do. And one of the best things was, of course, the training schools and the meetings.
No.
And I think that, of course, for all of us, it's kind of a shame that we cannot see each other. But on the other hand, for courses like this or for webinars like this, it's incredible the amount of people that have tuned in.
Yeah, for sure. I think also this macro video has been, I sometimes check it, it was like something like 9,000 clicks now. So if you would, I mean, of course, not every click watches everything and so on. I don't know what's the percentage of people that really watch the entire thing, but still, if you think of how many courses one would need to give for that, that's quite impressive.
Yeah. It's seriously impressive. And also the good thing is, it happened to me in a slightly different way. You know, we do a lot of microscopy training as well at the facility. Mm-hmm. So not only image processing, but how to handle the equipment. And then we also started, we need to do a lot of these trainings remotely now to try to minimize, you know, the amount of time that we spend in the labs, because the microscopy labs are very small. You know, social distancing there is extremely difficult. And then we have been doing a lot of work trying to, you know, improve the training in such a way that we can do a lot of it remotely. And one of the interesting things was that now I'm sitting on a bunch of material. So now every time somebody asks me a question about a microscope, I feel so lucky because now I have all of this stuff, so I can just send them a video. Even if I'm busy, I'm like, hey, I'm really sorry, I cannot talk to you this week, but, you know, have a look at this one. And I think there is quite some power into having these things recorded.
Yeah, for sure.
And also what I really like is that because people see that there is an interaction, like a conversation between two persons discussing about the microscope, they also understand that they don't expect perfection. You know, it's not like a super polished video, and then you know, you don't feel bad about sending a video where you are like sometimes like so, you know, it's okay because they recognize it. They see it's just two people talking about the microscope, and the information is there, so they can just pick it up.
I do this quite often also now when I have some users, like for example now I had one that wanted to see something in QPath, and then we just recorded. And then they can re-listen to it and so on. It's quite convenient. I usually then don't share it with others, but at least for that one user, they can use it.
Yeah, for me also, like I used to have to write all of these documentations about, you know, if I had to build a silly, let's say a simple macro for somebody that wanted some help, I usually had to send this documentation of, okay, how do you install it? How does it work? Where to click? What not to do? You know, like, when can it break? All of this stuff. Now, as you say, if the person is busy, I just record it on my own. It feels a bit silly to be talking to the emptiness, but it's okay. I was like, hey guys, you know, like, this is how you install it. This is how you use it. If it breaks, it's probably because of this, be careful, blah, you know, these sort of things. So that also made it very, very simple, and the people are very happy with these short videos because it really simplified the documentation of many things. So that's another advantage now that we can all, you know, we are used to this way of communicating in a way. But then I think one of the things I wanted to ask you as well is how did you get involved with all of these things? I mean, you during your PhD, were you doing a lot of image analysis, or how did you end up?
Yeah, it was so I'm a biologist by training, and then the PhD was in biophysics, and it was quite a cool lab. So they had it was a lot of microscopy and was very interdisciplinary also. So it was kind of half physicists, or I don't know, one third physicists, computer scientists, and biologists, or something like that. And then I was still kind of normal cell biologist doing experiments and doing microscopy and so on, but still they had already kind of automated the microscopes and had a lot of image analysis self-programmed, mainly in MATLAB it was at that time. It was quite cool. And I mean, I did not program nothing by myself during my PhD, but in the end of, I remember I did a MATLAB online course to finally learn it. and then this was also done during the postdoc. That was done at MPI-CBG in Eva Tolsch's lab, and there I was still mainly in the lab and doing a lot of microscopy, but there I did at least my own scripting of was also more than already after the image analysis to kind of what to do with the data then. But I remember that was kind of really the moment of when you can use this kind of programming knowledge for your own project. That was really super motivating. Like I remember even as a student, I mean, I knew a bit of programming, of course. I don't know, it's how you, even as a like school kid, probably I was doing a do loop already, but kind of you always have this boring or not so interesting examples. And then if you do this on your own projects and want to know and know where your chromosomes are moving to and so on, then it's super much more motivating to then go into that.
Yeah, it's very cool. And also I think that what is really nice sometimes is when you have been struggling with some kind of detecting a particular object, and then, you know, you find either an example or a paper, somebody that kind of describes an algorithm, and you kind of write it quickly, and suddenly the thing works. And it's just like, how does, because that was, I think, for me, what was super interesting at some point, because I was doing a lot of, physics as well. I was in a chemistry department, chemical physics. So we were doing a lot of spectroscopy and imaging of single molecules, but we were not doing them for the super resolution purposes. We were just doing them because we were studying the single molecules, right? And how they behave and so on.
Yeah, cool.
And then, so the image analysis part was fairly simple because it was just spot detection, basically. Yeah. So we just had spot detections, and then the very interesting stuff was all the other things like, intensity traces and what is happening with them and the spectrum and so on and so forth. But then I started to help biologists because we developed a method to study FRET. And of course, FRET is super important in some applications in biology. So I started to helping these guys. And then they bring me, for the first time, I see a brain slice, you know? So then they bring me these slices with some brain that had GFP and so on. And then I put it under the scope and I'm completely lost. I mean, I don't know. I don't even know where I'm supposed to look at, you know? So then I'm calling this guy over the phone. I'm like, look, I know this is for you super simple, but I don't know where is the part that you want me to look at. You know, he was like, you have to go to the olfactory bulb. I have no idea what is the olfactory bulb. So I was like doing these drawings and sending him pictures. And that's how I started, because then I had to like, you know, start to do tiling and stitching and reconstructions of images, and then correlation between different, you know, we had some different modalities and blah, blah, blah. And I remember the first time I was stitching everything by hand. And then I found some of these algorithms that help you to do a lot of this, at least semi-automatically, you know, a lot of the stitching is done for you. And I was like, I was really struggling for a couple of months. And then I tried one of these guys and it worked. And I was like, this is awesome.
This is, I guess, I mean, that's also this classical effect, right? When you show one of your users something and then they have this exactly this effect of, wow, it's going much faster and so on. That's, of course, it's still very nice, even after now quite some years in the facility. Nice moment.
It's super nice. And also sometimes it's nice because it's like very easy tricks, but it's like the devil is in the details. Like once you see the image, and because you have solved a similar problem, you're like, ah, let me try this. And then suddenly, you know, you're lucky, you nailed it, it works. And then the guy's like, how did you do that? I was like, ah, well, we did something similar before, but let me show you. And I think that feeling is what I really like at working at the facility.
Completely.
It's not anymore like you're happy alone in your office because you manage. It's also like somebody else is happy with you.
And for some reason, I don't know, you could compare this because I was first staff scientist at LMU Munich then at the core facility. And there I was still doing also microscopy introductions and image analysis. So maybe comparable a bit to what you're doing now. And I always found that you have more this effect of wow when you write them a little script and not so much on the microscope. Because I think maybe the effects are not so dramatic when you show them something on the scope. But
yeah, I think, well, I had a little bit of a mix of both. Like I think sometimes in the microscope might be a little bit less of that effect. But also I had a few people that come to a facility that they don't have their own microscopes, right? And they just have read this article. They are very good at biology. They know how to do many things, but they haven't really done much microscopy. So they have looked at the cells in, you know, the microscope of the department where everybody is doing like 20 different experiments. They have never been taken care properly or maybe it's not been set for the experiment, right? Doesn't have the right filters and blah, blah. So then they come to us, they come with a slide. And to be honest, even though they have looked at it, they have never really looked at it, you know? So then I put it in the...
That's true, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I put a few settings, I take the first snap and then you see that like... And they were like, yeah, it's working. You have good staining. And they are just so happy and they are so excited. And I think for that effect of it works is probably most like the strongest when they are doing a live cell experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think sometimes in fixed cells, you know, they kind of, you know, the picture doesn't kind of evolve over time, right? So you just see the cells and you can take very pretty pictures, but when you see the cells doing what you know what you want them to do, then I think that's really special. That's really cool.
Yeah, and nice.
So then you were doing your postdoc, you start to get more interested in these things and in programming and so on, and then how do you, it's that when you connect a little bit with the crowd from New Bias, or how do you jump in that
So I was still in Dresden, and then I already in the last year there, I was a bit more involved in facilities. So I was mainly doing high content screening then. But then I changed to Munich, and there I was really then very pure staff scientist. And then I moved 2015, if I remember correctly. And then I mean, I knew already some things that I remember. I was interested in this, in the bias course, or how it's called, at the EMBL, the COTAS course at EMBL. And then I applied, and then they said, it's a bit different target group that they want to reach with that course, but they are creating this network called New Bias. And then they basically pointed to the first course of New Bias then. And then I applied for that one, which was, so the first one I joined was this facility course from New Bias in Barcelona, 2016. and it was so great, this course. I remember then at that time I knew quite a lot already, but then it's not so bad still, because I mean, still there was so much to learn because it was a super packed course. So, and then actually I was a bit happy to have a bit of knowledge already, because then you could do these days that I don't know, I think they started at 9 and ended at 9, and then it was Barcelona, so it was like dinner at 11 and dessert at 12:30 in the night. It was complete destruction for like 4.5 days, but it was so amazing. Like I mean all courses were amazing, but I really especially remember this first course, and then the next course I joined was then the bioimage analyst school in Oerisch. And I think that was even a level even more great, because it, I don't know, I remember being in a wave of enthusiasm for this entire bioimage analysis school, just because also the, I mean, it was kind of all this community that was participating, and topics of course where content was super interesting and people were amazingly nice and the weather was great. I don't know, it was really everything together that was amazing. And I think in the end I more or less participated in each school except the one in Hungary. So because I think then it might have been already a school in Gothenburg.
Yes, there was one in Gothenburg just little bit before I arrived, I think. I remember the advertisement for that one.
And there I was teaching image macro. And then I was also organizing one, the one in Edinburgh, and so on. So I kind of was involved in nearly all of them. But it's I have to say, it's true that New Bias Academy has a lot of advantages with these webinars. And I mean, I think the community grew a lot by this also. But I think it could be time for meeting again in real life. It's missing a bit this, it's missing a bit the community feeling, of course.
Yeah, and there's something about these physical meetings, as you said, that, for example, I think it would be almost impossible to reach the same level of, let's say, concentration of a topic from 9 to 9 of webinars, you know. But sometimes when you have this, you know, like there is something about the fact that you are all in a room discussing, trying to, like, you know, program these things or like go through a pipeline, and you can really just stay from like 9 to 9, and perhaps even just after dinner you still are, you know, working on your computer trying to see if the thing works, It's very difficult to reproduce this on a webinar. I mean, webinars are good for like introducing topics and so on and so forth, but for really going into this, like, full blast practicing and I don't know, it's more challenging probably.
How was it for the last Gothenburg school you did was fully online?
Yes.
Right? Yeah. But you stretched it a bit on...
Yeah, so we...
So how was the atmosphere there?
Well, I would say that the students were very interactive by the end of the course. So it took some effort to make them loosen up in the remote sessions. I also think that we stretched it over 4 weeks because we didn't know how well they would handle the long days. So what we had is that we had 2 long days 1 week, then 2 long days next week, and so on. So at the end, we had something like 8 long days, but distributed in this fashion.
Which I think is a good idea. I mean, normally you cannot do this because nobody can stay then 4 weeks in Oerisch. But
So I think it worked out pretty well. Although this year we'll try to do it in 2 weeks, because one of the feedbacks that we got is that perhaps they felt that they would like to keep the tempo a little bit. So that they think that a break is good, but perhaps this break over the week was too long. So we used them to give them exercises and so on and so forth. But I think somehow they lost momentum and they got distracted with perhaps lab work and other things that they had to do, you know. And maybe we will try this year in 2 weeks and see how it goes. And then the very interesting things that here you have that we had to do was how to make it practical when we cannot sit with them. And the way we were doing it is that, of course, we have a very interactive session, so we are showing them things. We force them, probably is a good word, because we push them to do it. So you can force them a little bit to open the camera and to show the screen and try to do something with us, and we are kind of discussing about it. But then you'd give them an exercise and you give them a long break, perhaps a very long lunch break or something, so they play with the exercise. Yeah. Then also another thing we tried, and it worked a little bit by the end of the course, was that we will leave a Zoom open for the students to jump in and discuss with each other if they wanted to discuss about a homework, for example.
Did they do this?
Sorry?
Did they use this?
They used it a little bit by the end. Mm. So by the very end, a couple of people did stay a little bit. They used it less than I think what they should have, because it was quite interesting when they did. But also what we did is that we did the exercises and homeworks in pairs.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that they would have to work with somebody else from the course and submit something. And then that way they also started to talk to each other, and they made like little groups, right? So I have worked with this guy, then the next time I work with this other guy, and I kind of work out. So it's complicated.
Yeah. Mm.
But
I think the interactivity is really key. I mean, also in real courses, I think it's key, but somehow it's even more in the virtual ones.
Yeah, and but it's also you don't have all those these kind of physical cues or people like, or, and sometimes just hovering over the screen of somebody you can see at the screen, and you can notice that they are a bit lost or not, or but here is very difficult because you cannot really ask everybody to kind of show me your screen.
Yeah, exactly. And it's for me also in all this teaching, the virtual one was much slower than in real life. I think because I was like a bit super cautious to be like very precise in what I'm saying. So and normally I just look and okay, they look bored, but it's okay, let's speed up a bit. And okay, they need a bit more time here. And so it's much easier to adjust your speed when you see them.
Yeah. But also I think for me at the beginning, I had to go over this feeling that I don't mind if I'm recorded and if I, you know, like, there's something like when...
Yeah, it's true, we are recorded. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're recording all those. Yeah, because for me, it was at the beginning, it was a little bit odd because I didn't know two things could happen. And I think they happened to some degree, but then I went over, at least myself. One of them was, am I going to just be as spontaneous as usual and just like not mind about what I'm talking about, just kind of try to tell them a story? I usually try to just kind of... Perhaps I'm not super precise with my speech because you cannot be precise all the time. It's kind of tiring to think so much, but you kind of try to tell them a story and you correct yourself after 5 minutes. Ah, that thing I said, sorry, I was wrong, whatever. But the other part that I was afraid of was that the students would be less willing to make questions as well.
Yeah, that's true.
So then, of course, what we had to make sure was to tell them, look, these recordings is only for you guys. This is not going to go anywhere else because then the only interesting part is that you can go back to the question that somebody made that you didn't remember about, and you can just go and listen to it again. But you shouldn't feel like this is going to go all over the place and everybody is going to look at the questions that you made. So what we did is that we split a little bit the recordings that were more like an actual lecture where you can be more precise because you have control over 20 minutes of introducing a topic. So that we can record and distribute. But the other sessions, when we recorded them, was even the more practical sessions was just for them. So that they think that nothing is gonna, you know, that they are free to discuss. But it's tricky.
Yeah, it's tricky. And somehow, I don't know. I guess most people did similar experience. I have similar experience now after this 1 year, but I really wonder. I don't know. In theory, you could use so many advantages of that also, but in the end, it's missing a bit the time to really develop something that is then more focused or more targeted to an online version. I think the only thing that I really did once was doing this flipped classroom stuff. So I had recorded the cell profiler course, and then I just told them, okay, here's that's the video, please watch it. And then we had in the live session, basically we really had only questions, And it was, I don't know, there were not so many questions. That's why I was a bit unsure of how they liked it. Mm-hmm. But there were at least some interactivity there had been, and they asked some questions. And then I gave them an exercise that they had to solve. They managed, so I was okay. So that was the only thing where I really kind of, yeah, did a different style of teaching than I would do in real life.
And then, but then maybe something I can, if I go back a little bit, because you have done similar things to me. So how was for you the transition between being, let's say, a PhD postdoc where you, you know, as you said, you have your own project and everything, you know, every time you succeed, you are happy because, you know, your project is moving forward, to then go and work with users and at the facility. Like, was that something that that you did purposely? Was something that you kind of slowly got interested and went more into it? Or how was that experience for you?
Yeah, I think it was just a transition. I mean, for me, I think maybe it was also that my project did not work out so much. And then so I didn't have this effect. Indeed, I think I suffered a bit from this, that when somehow the project's not working for whatever reasons, and then actually I liked this in the facility that you have a kind of higher pace in success moments because you have like more changing projects change more often, and then that is actually something I liked. And for me, yeah, it was more like that at the end of the postdoc I realized, okay, this like to really continue in this classical way, this is not for me at all. And then, but still like to stay in the somehow connected to research, this I really like. I mean, I think the facility position is a bit underrated position. I don't know. I like it a lot because, of course, it's a varying, you have projects of varying length. So some are really more like collaborations and you do more like research style of work. And others are, of course, more small. And but then usually the small ones are these ones, like other ones where you have like very fast and an enthusiastic user that is happy about your script. So it's also nice, right?
Yeah.
But it's true that sometimes, of course, it happens that I have the feeling, okay, here maybe I would like to go in a bit of different speed than the users. I mean, of course, the users want it as fast as possible and have their ideas and so on. And then, of course, sometimes it happens that I feel a bit this limitations of, okay, you cannot just continue in any, like, yeah, in any directions now and so on. But it doesn't happen too often.
Yeah, yeah. Also for me, sometimes it's very, you get this mixed feeling when you have a user that you help, let's say, in a particular topic. Perhaps usually it has happened for me mainly when they come already with some images and they want some image analysis support. So I kind of help them a little bit. I you know, perhaps they come with dreams of great things, and I tell them, look, okay, with these images, really we cannot go there, but we can do at least this more simple version of what you're looking after. Let's do that, and you tell me if, you know, if it's helping you. So I go, I build something that I think is according to the quality of the images and how the data looks. But then I also tell them, but why don't you bring your samples to the facility and I show you a little bit this microscope? Yeah. Because, you know, if you want to do what you were asking at the beginning, I think we can do it, but we just have to, you know, record in a slightly different way. So I go, I show them, and then they are very excited, but then there comes the moment of truth, right? Like, are they going to invest on it or not? Mm-hmm. And then I had to learn to let it go. Like, you know, I had to learn to be very happy with the fact that they were interested and they were happy about the fact that they could do it, but the decision is not mine and I need to just let that go. You know, it's like you just plant a seed, let it go, and don't mind if they say no, because yeah. So that's the only thing I had to get used to. I have to be honest. That part, I had to get used to the fact that it could be much more, but okay.
For me, what also is sometimes difficult is if you have many projects, and then of course So hey, you really need to learn to manage time much more efficiently than I did before. And then also I have the feeling that like in all projects, I only can work like a small increment than to kind of treat them all. I don't know, it depends of course of how the users really then need the result and so on, but often it happens quite often that you need to really work on all of them, but then of course you can only work a little bit on all of them, and then it's a bit difficult. And if you have just like 1 hour that you can do something, I mean even 1 hour is already actually quite a lot <Well done. Yeah. laughs> if you have like 1 hour in a one piece, that's it's already an achievement.
Yeah,
that can be a bit difficult, I find, but it's okay.
Yeah, and also then, because now I don't know why it popped into my head. I saw somebody, I don't know what field it was. I think it was by informatics or something, that somebody was complaining, saying something along the lines like, you know, this line of research is not, it's not a service, it's research. You know? And then I was thinking about that and I was like, well, it's actually kind of both, right? At least in image processing. I don't know exactly in that field, but I was thinking about it. It actually made me think a lot about it for some reason. I don't know. I just read it and it kind of stuck into my brain. But it's true, like in some, as you say, some projects are very like quick and defined and it's really like a service. You don't know exactly what to do. You just help them and then go. But then some others, it's really like, okay, for this, we actually have to go into research mode. Like we cannot...
Yeah.
Just build something out of the blue and it will work. So we have to really think. So it's nice when you have a nice balance between the two. So you have a few that are more like really research, as you say, collaboration almost, and the other ones that are just service, and you feel good about the fact that, okay, I did something good today, you know, like I get my check mark. Yeah.
And then, of course, there's also teaching and so on. So it's, I think it's quite some variation in this.
Yeah. And then, but for example, how is it for you being at Uppsala, and okay, for those that do not know where Uppsala is, you can go to the map and check. So it's not like the closest
I
town.
Also had to check it before I before
you accepted.
I checked where is this Uppsala actually.
So how is it to live in Uppsala?
It's nice. So it's 70 kilometers from Stockholm. So it's not, if you really like big cities, you can go there. But I actually like the size of towns. I think I come from Fürth, nobody knows, but it's very close to Nuremberg. And it's kind of this, it's 100,000 residents. So it's kind of comparable feeling of living, I think. So that's why I think I feel quite comfortable. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, of course, for you, you said you did your PhD already in Sweden, and we were discussing before a bit. And for me, it was the first time really. I mean, I was in the US for 5 months during my PhD, but I mean, that was not so permanent. So this was the first time really moving away. And then, yeah, it was not... For me, it was okay. The priority was of course, more the kind of the job and the facility is attached to Carolina Velvi's group, and then she's really doing very cool research. And I remember coming to they had offered me the job, and then they invited me to visit the group also, and then hearing all these projects, it was really super interesting. And then. Yeah, and then this job was in Sweden. And then I mean, of course, if the same job would have been in, I don't know, Australia, then probably I would not have liked to move so far away. So it was important where it is also. But I had the feeling, okay, Sweden is not so different maybe from Germany.
So that was actually my next question. So how is the change? Because okay, I come from a different continent, different everything. So for me, the shock was just obvious. But how is it for you?
Yeah, no, it's I know in the first glance, it doesn't seem so different, but then it is different actually. And it's a bit funny because for example, when I was in Dresden, then of course MPI is like super international. And I was kind of, because I also didn't know any Germans or very few Germans in Dresden, I was kind of living as an international in Germany. And then there were always like the Spanish and Italian colleagues who were like, oh man, these Germans, they're so, I don't know, there are these kind of stereotypes, of course, that you don't enjoy life and so on. And, and sometimes here in Sweden also, of course, I see some things where I feel like I'm, I don't know, an Italian in Germany. They are, of course, more closed and, I don't know, of course, sounds, but indeed, it experience also that many Swedish people are indeed a bit more closed. And but the work in, I don't know what, because at work environment, it's really great. Also, this is a bit like the reputation, right? I don't know. I think I never had such a good working environment as now. And also there, I would say my Swedish colleagues are actually quite funny and open.
I mean, it takes a little bit to sometimes for some, let's say it's perhaps a stereotype, but it does apply in many cases, that it takes a little bit of time to get them sort of loose and more like start talking and more relaxed, you know. And also I think for me, what really surprised me is that they really don't like to bother people, right? Mm. So the idea is that it's not that they don't want to talk to you or they don't want to interact, but they just don't want to bother you. Like, you know, if they see you that you're a little bit busy, you know, it's not, because that was one of the first thing. It was very strange for me is that I would, you know, in Venezuela, just to put an example, if you are walking around and you see somebody, you say hello very loudly and they respond to you, hello. And then say hello like 100 different times before you arrive to the office. You see it, you say hello to all your office mates and, you know, these type of things. And then I arrived to Sweden. I was working in my office and I had a slightly different working hours than the colleague that was sitting with me. So usually he will arrive a little bit after me. And then he will come into the office and he will never say hello. And then I was like, this is a bit strange because he's so nice in the coffee breaks and he just talks to me and everything. But why in the morning he doesn't say hello to me? You know, I didn't get it. And then once I actually asked him, like, look, is it that you're grumpy in the mornings? You need your coffee? Or, you know, why don't you say hello? He's like, no, it's just you're busy in your computer. I don't want to like bother you, you know, like just kind of. He was trying to be polite. And I was like, OK, this is a different way of doing things. So,
for me it's maybe also not so difficult because I'm also sometimes like that. So for example on the bike, I also don't like to ring people out of my way, which I've heard people here in Sweden complain about this, that Swedish people don't ring the cycle bell. Indeed, I also don't like to do, and it's also in Germany I didn't like to do. So I see some behavior somehow fits to mine also. So it
fits to your character, you know. And how is the weather? Like, it's still a change, yeah? Like,
yeah, no, it's true. It's a change. And like this, it's not, I'm thinking now with kind of these short days in winter, and I, for the first winter, for example, I did not mind at all, but I think in the second or now in the third winter, I really could feel like, oh, wow, like it's just, especially, I mean, everyone was telling me this, you know, but I indeed, like in November, when it's like gray for days and sun, sometimes I have to laugh of how gloomy it can be. I'm like, where am I?
What have I done?
But it's true that this can be a bit hard. And Uppsala is so small, but then it's super nature, of course. I mean, also where I live, like really directly behind my building is the forest, the city forest, and where you can walk like It's a very nice forest, actually. And then there's like the lakes very close by and so on. And then, and this I really enjoy. I was never super unsporty, but I was always also not super sporty. And here I don't know, I started cross-country skiing and I started rowing here.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, and swimming. And I don't know, I became suddenly like not super sporty still, not, but quite sporty.
This outdoors, let's say.
Yeah.
No, that's that's also one of the things I really did like of Sweden and that I missed. So as you mentioned, like I did my PhD in Lund. So I went to Belgium, and Belgium, you know, it's kind of not only that it's small the size of the country, but that the cities are very close to each other. And they have done quite some effort to try to still keep sort of green areas. So you have still like forests that are around the cities. So you can kind of walk, you have long hikes that you can try to stay within the forest and you can move through the country. So it's still, they try to do the best they can to keep this feeling that you can go into the forest and walk. But you always had this, like, if you walk a bit too much to the right or to the left, you start to hear the traffic or you see the houses, mm-hmm. or, you know. And I really like the fact that here in Sweden, I can still feel like when I was back home that you can go into a forest and just get lost, you know, like you can really... And there is something about that that is really, for me, relaxing, and I really enjoy. So I really like the fact that also I'm living a little bit outside of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So then I really like that, you know, we have lakes around, we have the forest around. We, you know, every time I take the bus to go to work, I see the cows, and, you know, it's like it's a nice connection with nature. So that's something which is very nice in Sweden, that you still have that connection with nature, and it feels really, really good.
Yeah, and it's also like everyone, or I don't know, I guess maybe it's again my colleagues, they are so outdoor people and so on, and then they tell all the time about the ice skating and I don't know what, yeah, all kinds of sports and so on. And in, yeah, I mean, it's little things also sometimes, so like we get this sports allowances, or how it's called, like, yeah, it's... In the beginning, I was like, okay, what should I do? I was like, okay, how do I spend this? And then I think the first year I just bought like a swimming entry into swim hall or so. It's stupid because it's small things, but still it's kind of, I think it's the entire attitude maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. So for people that don't know, in the Swedish system, what happens is that when you work in many companies, and I think it's in all, you know, like, because we are working at the university, so we work for the state, let's say, but also every company I think has this, is that you have this allowance every year. You have a certain amount of money that you can spend on sports equipment or sports in general. So you can, let's say, if you would like to go to the gym, you go, you pay your you pay the fee, and then you can bring back the receipts to your workplace, and then you get kind of part of the money back if it's within the allowance, right? So that's also something which is very very special and very nice, that they kind of, yeah, they in a way they support people to go out and do sports. And and it's very common also that you will have like the like a football pitch or a volleyball court or something like at the university or at the company where people go and play, and you can rent. Also, this is also something that I don't, maybe in Germany is the same, but you know, you have all of these sports halls that belong to the schools or to, you know, to universities and things like that, and you can go and rent it. So you can just go and play for 1 hour in the sports hall, and you just have to pay something to this. To this organization, and it's really nice, because that's the way I used to play a lot of football, of indoor football in Lund, and I had like five different groups of friends, and they were all renting a different day a pitch in one of the schools, and we were all going and playing, and
cool.
It's really nice that you have that opportunity, because if not, those sports halls are empty at night, right? So what are they going to do? So then it's just the crazy PhD students that have nothing to.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. How did you feel about going into such a technical field and being let's say a girl? Was it easy for you in the meaning, like, did you find that the environment was welcoming to you, that there were other girls around doing the same thing like you, or you didn't care, you didn't even think about it? Like, did you have any particular experiences in that regard?
I mean, when I studied biology, I mean, biology is not, it's actually maybe even more women studying biology in Germany. But then it's true that especially then in the facility, I think it was especially, I remember then, I mean, the postdoc is still, okay, quite balanced, but then the facility and in microscopy, that's true that this is more male based. And I also remember in Munich, then, I mean, sometimes we had these meetings with the Leica people, and then I was like it was like 8 men and me in a room or so. And it's true that, yes, I have to say that sometimes I've felt a bit these kind of, I very sure unconscious biases I could sometimes feel, or I had the impression I can feel maybe. It's not so easy because sometimes, I don't know, I think, yeah, sometimes you also can be stressed or so, and then you maybe detect something that maybe is not, I don't know, it's a bit harder. But now, I mean, now here in Sweden, or especially in this group, it's we are very balanced, which is really cool, considering that the image analysis is, again, of course, the situation is that there are much more men in this field than women. But in Uppsala, I mean, of course, Carolina is there. And then in the facility, we have Giselle Miranda, who is actually now a John Zuckerberg fellow since a few months. And then also that is the facility, we are completely balanced. And then since we are attached to, like, at least us in Uppsala, we are attached to Carolina's group, and her group is, again, I think, pretty much balanced gender-wise, and the entire division for some reason is balanced. And this is super nice. And I realized that it's just not, there's just not, this entire topic is just not there for some reason. And that I still realize that it's just normal. You just do your job and nobody really cares what, like, you don't feel any, or very, I think I had one situation where I would say I felt a bit of gender problem, but.
No, but also I think that what happened, the reason why I was asking you is because I still think that usually when I would think or go to a place where they're just doing more courses on, let's say, programming, like, forget about the image processing, just programming type of things, you will still see a lot of much more, like males and females. Mm. But on the other hand, there is something that I found very interesting, is that recently to the applications of the different workshops and courses that we do for image processing, then the applications come in quite 50-50.
Mm.
So and that's something that is very interesting, because for other things, like more data science and some other things, I don't know how it goes, but at least for me locally, to the courses that we do, we are receiving as many applicants that are girls and that are guys. Mm-hmm. And that makes everything a lot easier, because also there's something to be said to the fact that perhaps nobody's trying to do, like, there's no particular bias or anything, but if you have a room where, as you said, you have 8 guys and 1 girl, then the conversations are always going to be skewed somehow, because, you know, usually maybe they have a different humor, or they interact with each other in a different way, so you might feel a little bit, you know, like kind of odd in some sense. So it does help when the room is 50-50 or something close to it.
No, I think it also, for some reason, it like there's this list with this female with microscopes, right? And then I think, like, here in Sweden, there are really many dots, or at least in, like, also in Stockholm, there are quite many, also research groups, right? There's Emma Lundberg's group, and there's Charlotte Stadler, who's doing also this multiplexed imaging and so on. So I have also, I don't know, then it maybe attracts also, I don't know, at least if I feel very comfortable, of course, in a surrounding where it's just not a matter, feel more comfortable than maybe if it's only male. I don't know, I'm not, I wouldn't call myself an activist so yeah. much, but I still, I don't know, I of course I'm a bit interested in this, and I observe, and sometimes I'm like, oh no, why do that? Why do they do this like this, and I get annoyed and so on. But I also, for example, I was reading one post some time ago already, like I forgot her name actually, but she like is a researcher from Janelia, and she was like thinking, is a computer scientist, and she was thinking back of her female mentors or female role models when she was studying. And then I was also thinking back of studying biology 20 years ago, right? Yeah, in yeah. Germany. And then indeed there was nearly no female professor at that time. And as I said, the students are more or less half half. And then I checked again the page now, 20 years later, like 20 years later, to a situation where students were already half half, right? And right. still they have like 20, I think they have 20, the faculty is 20 people, and they had like 2 female professors. Mm-hmm. And there, I don't know why. I am a bit shocked.
Yeah.
I mean, in this situation, or now there was this ESC grants, and also Germany had a very bad gender balance. And I mean, of course, there are then so many reasons. And then, of course, if there are many more, much more male PIs than females, of course, you will get more applications and so on. So I'm not saying everything should be 50-50, because sometimes it's not possible. But at least they should kind of reflect on it. So I mean, I don't know. I found it weird that they just published it without saying, okay, maybe we could investigate. Maybe what is behind this? I don't know. This
because I think a bit really, weird. Even I mean, the fact that the people that get the grant are distributed like that, it's perhaps even less sad than what if the number of applicants, as you said, was so skewed. Because you know, like you would expect that at least the number of applications are kind of, you know, close to have more representation, right? So if it's, it depends on the field. So that would be the question. Like the question is, why would there be fields where you have so
exactly
applicants?
Yeah, that's, no, exactly.
Yeah. So that's.
And then, so this, of course, I kind of, you're forced to think about this.
And then maybe another question, maybe to go into a silly, you know, a silly question here. Is there any like particular application of bioimage analysis that, which is the one that you like the most, like the one that you find the prettiest, or like, I know that it sounds silly, but sometimes, I mean, I do see myself enjoying more some type of projects than others. So is there a project that you kind of really like to work on, or you just depends on the scientific question, or
I don't know. It depends. I think it depends. I mean, of course, I don't know. For me, it's really I don't know. It's more like if a project, if they have good images, for example, I enjoy much more than if they have bad images. And then, it depends indeed a bit more maybe on the interactions that you have then with the group, and if it's a nice interaction, and maybe you even have interactions with your colleagues about it and so on. That makes a fun project. Yeah, I mean, some images maybe are nice to watch. I know, for example, I liked once I had a zebrafish blood flow project. It was so cute to look, or not cute, but I don't know, maybe also, but it was very nice to look at them because we could see the red blood cells in the fish. And this is, it's maybe those moving cells, which are signals, are nice, but then also, if you have some tissue and all these different stains that people do, it can also be aesthetic at least.
Yeah,
I think it's maybe more the, we had like now a project, like already, it's also already, I think half a year ago or so, but we had users that came already to an initial meeting with this perfect presentation of, I don't know, we were, like it was a colleague and me in this meeting, and we were both like very shocked about how perfect they presented this, because I mean the way of what, which details they shared and what they had tried before, and then like matching colors and everything in magenta and green, and like they had all these checkpoints perfect. And then they had like, I mean, they had an enormous amount of manually annotated data then, and all of this was nicely organized in like the raw, they had then saved the raw manager in Fiji in a very systematic way, and I don't know, was just it was just the perfect way of starting such a project. That was very nice.
Yeah, because I also think like from my side, there's a few projects going around, and I really like when you have this sort of live cells moving in 3D. So either being because they are migrating in some sort of matrix, or because you have like a 3D model. There's something which is just so attractive about those movies that you can just like, you know, go in like forward, backwards, that I think for the moment that's like my little aesthetic love, you know, like just about aesthetics. There's something about those videos that is very mesmerizing in a way.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think sometimes people maybe don't push enough the fact that we work with such pretty data sets sometimes. Like they can be made so attractive, so much eye candy if you put a little bit of effort instead of just like crunch numbers. Like because really they're so pretty sometimes that you show them to somebody on the street, they don't even know what it is, they will be like, whoa, that's cool. And I do manage to enjoy the collateral beauty of what we do.
That's true. Do you have a gallery in your facility where you...
Yeah, we have a small, the only thing there is, that's the other thing, is that sometimes you because this data belongs to the users, so you are a little bit like you have to go ask them for permission and things like that. Most of the times they are very happy, but they will ask you like, you should wait until we publish, and
yeah, it's true.
And then it kind of it removes the nice flow of, you see a nice picture that you can just put out just to say, look how cool this is. So there's a few users that I know that they have already told me, okay, if you want, it's no problem, so we can put these pictures out there, and that's kind of nice. But in some other cases you can't. So it's easier when it's either in a collaboration, when it's always your own cells, so then you don't mind, you know, you just do whatever you want, and it's easier to put them out there. But biology at that scale can be very pretty.
No, I think I also always enjoyed this, and I also, it's still when I was working in the lab, of course, to kind of have your view, kind of watch your cell dividing and so on. This, of course, at some point it becomes normal, but it's quite impressive.
Yeah. And I think one of the other ones that happened recently is just because sometimes, you know, I'm not biologist by training. So what I have learned is either because of the projects I have been involved, or people teaching me, or just me reading and things like that during my work. And sometimes I still are very surprised, like a cell does something. I was like, I didn't know a cell could do that. And then the guy said like, yeah, they do that all the time. I was like, what do you mean all the time? So especially like sometimes, you know, like cancer cells or so stuff like that sometimes they do weird stuff. And I'm like, what is that? What? Exactly.
How it whites, but doesn't do white.
Exactly. Yeah. What is going on here? Yeah, so I still managed to enjoy those ones. But then Anna, I think it's well, for me it's been quite fun. So thanks for joining
the same
little experiment. And I don't know if there's anything that you want to sort of advertise before we close up, or if there's any activity that you are going to be participating at some point that you want people to know about.
I'm thinking of something where you could still sign up, which I think there's nothing. there will be the EMBO practical course on kind of advanced bioimage analysis methods, which is will be actually a completely virtual course. But I'm thinking of something which is, yeah, I think there's nothing where you could sign up. If you are more like in Sweden, then of course you can sign up for our facility newsletter. That's maybe something. But
And you also have your nice call for help. So if people are, you know, in Sweden, mm-hmm. and they need help, they can go contact you. And you might.
We had Rafa that, also yeah. very active in it.
Yes,
it was very fun actually.
Yeah. And it's also fun for us, not only for the people that come ask for help, but it's also
exactly
to see each other. So that I think is also a nice thing that people should know. And if it's not here with us, also just reach out to the facilities that you have around you, because I'm sure that nowadays you probably have facilities around you that can try to help you at this point, you in the right direction and find the right group of people that can, you know, give you some ideas.
And, check New Bias Academy, of course.
Check New Bias Academy and check the image.se forum, because there also you will meet all the people that actually are in this field. And I'm so surprised how fast people reply to a question.
That's true. It's shocking. I actually thought, okay, for every post I ask, I should at least reply the same amount. I think in last time
but sometimes they just beat you to it, you know, you just try to see around and then you see an interesting question, you click on it and then you already have people that reply. You're like, these guys are very fast.
It's incredibly active.
Exactly. So, well, again, Anna, thanks a lot for everything.
Thank you. Very nice initiative here. Who will you have next? You will not tell, probably. It's a surprise.
Surprise! Yeah, we can talk about it afterwards. I can let you know the idea that I'm having.
The insider knowledge.
Exactly. Okay.
Okay.
Ciao,
thank you.